You're listening to the Denver Real Estate Investing Podcast, where it's all about helping you grow your Denver real estate portfolio. Here's your host, Chris Lopez.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode. Today, I've got John Wilms of First Bank with me. So John is a bank officer over there, and I asked him to come over here today to talk about loans and financing investment property. So John, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Chris.
So before we jump into all the financing stuff, just tell us about First Bank.
Yeah, definitely. So First Bank was founded in Lakewood, Colorado in 1963. It is an employee-owned, privately held bank here in Colorado. Our headquarters are actually still here in Lakewood, Colorado. Right now we have kind of our presence in Colorado, kind of through the Front Range, up through the I-70 corridor, as well as in Maricopa County of Arizona, so kind of around Phoenix area, as well as in the Coachella Valley of California. So that's kind of where our presence is. And, you know, we've kind of organically grown throughout lending, providing banking services and community investment, and not through acquisition. So as of right now, we're the second largest bank in the state of Colorado by deposit and the second biggest business donor in the state.
Great. And you've worked with a lot of clients of Charles and mine on helping them get financing for their investment property. So I just want to like dive into the details on, you know, just what type of lending you can do and what First Bank can offer. Because from my understanding, First Bank does conventional lending and portfolio lending. Now, I'm not the expert. Could you just give everyone a quick rundown as to what conventional is and what portfolio lending is?
Yeah, definitely. So from a high level, the conventional lending products are going to be kind of your Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac underwritten products. That is going to be your 30-year fixed, your 20-year fixed, your 15-year fixed, the kind of loan products that you're going to think of whenever you're talking about a loan initially. Now, the portfolio loan products, those are going to be typically adjustable rate mortgages. Now, with that is we do maintain those on our portfolio. So different from the conventional lending, which are typically originated by either a non-bank lender or a bank lender and then sold to the secondary market to a series of investors, and the portfolio ones are actually maintained on First Bank books. So we actually do keep those and service those in both cases as well.
So, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but conventional products have very strict guidelines set by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac so they can be sold in the secondary markets, where your portfolio loans that you keep in-house, there's a lot more discretion and rules that you can create that fit First Bank's risk portfolio, right?
Yeah, definitely. So with a conventional lending, I always describe it as it needs to fit in a nice little box. At the end of the day, the loan officer in those instances really becomes, you know, processor where, hey, I need this documentation. Give me this documentation. And once we fulfill those conditions per the underwriter, then we can fund the loan. Whereas with portfolio underwriting, we're kind of quote unquote the judge, jury, executioner in the sense that, you know, I'm taking the app, I'm actually completing the underwriting, I'm taking it for approval, and then I'm also there at closing. So not only is that kind of the process behind it, but we also are going to be underwriting to First Bank policy. So the risk appetite that we have, where we feel comfortable being able to originate that loan.
Now, are there any like very strict or black and white guidelines that First Bank has that you can, you know, share with us that's different from conventional, or is it all kind of depend on the bigger risk portfolio?
No, I would say it depends on the bigger risk portfolio, but I guess kind of catering to that question a little more is I would say that, you know, in conventional lending, there's kind of a hard and fast, you know, amount of years since bankruptcy, foreclosure. You know, admittedly, we do look towards a little bit longer period as far as that goes, because that's where our risk appetite just isn't there for that. So, you know, we're typically looking for, you know, beyond 7 years from any of those major credit deficiencies. And on the other hand, conventional lending is going to typically cater to hard and fast credit scores, where we're not a risk-based lender. So we're not going to base our pricing off of where the loan to value is at or where the credit score is at. We're going to more base it off of what is that, what's saying on that credit score? Do you have, you know, tons of late pays? Do you have those issues? Do you have high revolving balances in relation to their limits? Then that's when we're going to start looking at it a little bit closer and saying, hey, what's going on? It's not going to be, hey, you have a 620 credit score, we can't do this loan.
Okay, so there's a lot of nuances in here. So let me ask you this. So let's say I'm an investor. I call you up. I say, hey, John, I want to buy a rental property here in Denver. what's the process do you take? What's the kind of first common questions that you start asking me?
Yeah, definitely. I think first and foremost, you want to understand, you know, the property in of itself, the collateral. Where is this property located? What type of property is it? Is it going to be a single family detached home, single family attached home, condominium? Because then that'll start to understand how do we need to really look at this subject property from an analysis standpoint. You know, is it a condominium? Well, is it non-warrantable or is it warrantable? That's going to kind of be the first question. Then the next question is going to understand the income and your debt. I mean, relatively straightforward. We are a lender. We're going to look at debt and income. We just look at it a little bit differently. So we're going to want to understand, hey, how much debt do you have out there? Are we refinancing any of that debt? Or are we going to be looking towards, you know, obviously taking on new debt? Where's your income? What type of income do you have? Is it salary? Is it self-employment? Because then that'll also drive some of the documentation requirements we have.
So when I come to you, do I already need to know what type of property I want to purchase, or should I contact you first to kind of figure out my personal financing situation, to figure out what you can or can't do with me?
Yeah, I always think it's smart to contact, you know, whether it be me, First Bank, or any lender in general, and kind of understand where your financials are at that point in time, because then that can help kind of cut out some of the back and forth, because maybe you're going to be looking for a single family detached, but in reality, maybe the condo price points can be a little bit better for you. So no, you don't need to know exactly the property. Feel free to reach out and just understand what you can qualify for. And then that can maybe drive some of where you're going to be looking from a price point perspective.
And as far as like, you know, for self-employed people and, you know, business owners, and I'm really curious about this for myself as well, like, what do you look for in terms of, like, you know, income history requirements on that standpoint if it's a self-employed person?
Yeah, when we're talking about, you know, purchasing an investment property and there's self-employment in there, we just want to understand the history behind that self-employment. Have they been previously self-employed? Are they in the same field as, you know, maybe previous employment? Are they going from a wage employee to maybe 1099 and maybe then starting their own business? Or is it they just starting their own business outright and they have no experience in that field? Well, then that's going to kind of cater to what can we really get done? Because can we really project that income? If you have a year's worth of income, you know, for example, working in real estate, well, it's going to be hard if you have no prior experience in real estate.
Yeah.
Now, when we're starting to look at it from the opposite perspective, let's just say that you are an engineer for a company. Maybe you became a contract engineer, and then finally you decided to go start your own business and your business is, you know, kicking off this type of income. Well, we feel confident that based off of your prior skill set and knowledge base that you can at least continue at that same type of income. Now, that's just kind of the little bit of nuance between how we're going to look at your income.
And I know for like conventional lending, it's generally like 2 years of self-employment history. Is that the general guideline you guys use, or is it more nuances you were just describing?
Yeah, we hope for 2 years, but okay, it's not a hard and fast rule.
Well, let me use my own personal situation. Sure. Because, you know, I've been an agent for about a year now, and it's starting a new business for me. So I'm self-employed. Prior to this business, I ran a couple of internet businesses that I built from the ground up. You know, self-employed for years, eventually put them in like an LLC, then an S corp or something. Mm-hmm. But the last couple of years, I stepped away. My business partner and I did, and as we're figuring our next steps in life, we wanted to do. You know, on paper we still own it. In reality, is we're just kind of riding out the residuals, where I spend probably 2 hours a month just answering through emails and kind of maintaining the books is all I do. So I've got history there, but that income right now, it's dropped off last couple of years since we're not working anymore. But I've got, you know, a brand new, I'll say, real estate agent business I'm doing. Where would you go from there? Is it just, hey, what are your financials? What are your numbers? Like, where would you go?
Yeah, so me personally, I would look at it and say, hey, Chris has the experience previously as a self-employed borrower. So he understands what it takes to, you know, own your own business. So that's one portion that I'd give you a little bit of credit for. Now, with that, you know, being probably not tied as much towards real estate, you know, I'd really look at, okay, well, what is the income showing for that 1 year worth of income history? Okay, well, there'll probably be a little bit of shocking, because although it has been a really good last few years in the real estate industry, we can't always say that that income is going to be that way from, you know, here on out to infinity. Yep. Hopefully it could increase, but, you know, from a conservative underwriting standpoint, we would maybe discount it a little bit, but obviously give you credit for it. So that's where we look at it, depending on kind of your prior experiences. And if it kind of matches up in one way or another, but not perfectly, we'll take a look at it.
And even so, like, because, you know, basically my, you know, the last year I was in an agent for, I don't know, 8 months, maybe 10 months on paper. But, you know, on paper, I basically about broke even. I probably showed a couple grand profit, but just reinvested everything.
Sure.
Had a lot of expenses. I mean, so on paper, my income last year was, you know, it doesn't look that great. How does that factor into things?
Definitely. So I think one common misconception that, you know, we run into as maybe a portfolio lender is that we will take your word for maybe what your internal financials will show, you know, a little bit more income and a less expense, and then your tax returns will show a lot of write-offs. Admittedly, you know, we are going to be going off that tax return because that is the most, you know, quantified and confirmed financial perspective, right?
Yep.
So I think the message that I would always kind of send is, and it can be kind of blunt, is, you know, you do kind of have to pay to play. And I know that that can be tough to hear from a self-employed borrower, because at the end of the day, you're out there, you're working hard, and, you know what income you make, but I do have to document it.
Yeah, absolutely. And we were talking before we started recording, going to the debt to income side of things. I guess conventional lending normally does a back end ratio, but First Bank does a front ratio. So can you first describe what a back end ratio is and what a front end ratio is, so we all understand that?
Yeah, absolutely. So your back ratio is going to be kind of your standard debt to income, where, you know, the, I'd say the hard and fast ratio that lenders are going to look for is between 43 and 45%. So 0.43 or 0.45 of your debt to your income, where the front ratio.
Let me just interrupt you here. So let's just say I made $100,000 last year. And so they'd be looking at no more debt than, you know, 43 to 45,000 based off that 100,000 gross, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yep.
Now with that same model, you know, describe the front ratio and how that would work too.
Yeah, absolutely. So then we're going to look at it maybe being the exact opposite, where we'll say that we need you more or less to have 2-to-1. So it gives you almost a little bit more credit in there. So let's just say then you would make 100,000. Well, ideally we could maybe give you a $50,000 loan. Or
so,
50,000 in available debt.
How is that different from 50% on the back end?
It's not that much different,
okay.
But I'd say where the front ratio is a little bit different is, I say the general rule is 2-to-1. Now that's going to be on a sliding scale. So depending on where your residual income is, so that's your total income less the debt that you have to pay. So let's just say you make 100,000, you have to pay 30,000 in your current debt obligations. Well, let's just say we can give you an additional loan for up to 20,000. And now that is over the course of the year, right? Let's keep that on an annualized basis.
Yeah.
Well, that residual income is going to allow you to have maybe 1.7 in a front ratio.
Okay.
So it gets a little bit more of a sliding scale. So as you have more income, it's going to be hard to maintain a 2-to-1 type of ratio, right? If you're making $1 million, to say that you can only have $500,000 worth of debt would be somewhat unfair due to the fact that you could really probably service more debt than that.
So it would actually slide up more as generally, so make sure you understand. So as the income grows, that ratio would actually slide up more to where you would be comfortable with a higher debt to income ratio.
Correct.
Okay.
More or less. Yep. So it would, let's just say you're going to make 30,000 after you pay all your, you know, debt obligations. Well, then we're going to look towards 2.5 being that kind of front ratio. To, let's just say you're going to make over 100,000. We're going to be looking closer to that being around 1.7.
Okay. Now, I know First Bank will lend through LLCs, and I know conventional lenders generally will not, or actually probably won't. So first of all, you do lend through LLCs, right?
Yeah. So
what are the requirements to do that?
Definitely. So we lend to LLCs, no problem. Now that will limit your available loan products. Conventional, you do have to vest as an individual, where that would limit you to a portfolio loan product. So you'd have to feel comfortable looking towards an adjustable rate mortgage. So that's, I'd say, the first requirement that people should be aware of. The second one is you do have to personally guarantee it. So while we do make the loan directly to TBD LLC, Joe Schmo would have to guarantee that loan personally. So should TBD LLC dissolve, Joe Schmo would still continue to pay that loan.
And then do you have the same underwriting guidelines for that personal guarantee that we just talked about, or does that start shifting?
Yeah, so we would underwrite it towards the person. Now, if you're several single, you know, entities, so, you know, you have your one rental property, typically your address LLC, you know, we're okay kind of running with that and just underwriting you personally, because there's not going to be a terrible amount of income from that side. Now, let's just say that's become seasoned and everything like that. We can go about it a couple ways. If you file separate tax returns, getting that income and understanding that, or looking at it from a lease perspective, which a fully executed lease would give us the information we need.
Now, let's just say, because this is one option I'm considering as I buy a couple more properties, is I may put an LLC and do it with my old business partner, and we would do that just for, you know, protection and simplicity like that. So let's say, you know, right after we finish recording this, I go set up an LLC. So mm-hmm. it's a brand new LLC that's, you know, Chris and Jason LLC. And I say, hey, I'm ready to go, you know, I want to go out there and buy some property. What do you look for? Would you underwrite myself and Jason equally to the same requirements of what you said, like no major credit deficiencies in the past 7 years, about a 2-to-1 front end ratio? Like, what would that personal guarantee underwriting look like?
So we would look at you guys to be able to service that debt individually and joint.
Okay.
Now, if you were to just say we could split the debt evenly and you'd both be able to service that, that's great. Let's just say Jason couldn't service any of the debt by himself, but Chris could, then we could go ahead and assess all the debt to you and you guys being jointly obligated to that. So we can look at it from a couple different perspectives, but typically the hard and fast is just splitting the debt evenly and making sure that you can qualify.
And that would still just roll back to our personal income with that 2-to-1 DTI. And generally, as long as you have no major issues with our credit, kind of those would be the...
Yep, exactly. Okay. So we would underwrite you personally. And I'd say generally that's what we're going to be looking for. Now, let's take it a step further and say, you know, Jason and Chris LLC has been in business for 10 years and maybe they have 15 properties under that. Well, let's go ahead and look at what can that entity service the debt at. Oh, if it can service the debt, great. Well, obviously, we're still going to go ahead and make sure that you can service the debt personally should that entity dissolve. But we'll also look at it from a business perspective as well, because that can also tell a lot about what your qualification is.
Okay. Now, shifting gears here, what type of loan products does First Bank offer?
Yeah, so we're a full service lender. So we offer your residential mortgages, whether that be for commercial investment purpose or for your consumer purpose. Once again, going back to that conventional loan and your portfolio loan. Now, alternatively, we have true commercial real estate loans. So that's going to be, you know, your office building, your multifamily building, your industrial building, being able to, you know, finance those properties.
And is there a minimum threshold for commercial? If you say commercial, you mean like a million plus? Like, what defines commercial to you?
No, we're willing to pretty much do anything from a dollar perspective.
Okay.
Now, whether that be a commercial condo where, you know, your landscaper is looking to, you know, buy their own space, then we'll do that loan. And sometimes those can be between $150,000 to $350,000 loan amount. And, you know, or whether it be the commercial construction to build a 108 unit multifamily apartment complex, we can do the full scheme as far as that goes. So that's kind of the commercial real estate lending side. Alternatively, you know, I think another prudent lending product that we have is our regular single advance for fix and flip. So we can finance the acquisition of property.
Say that again.
So it'd be a regular single advance is what we call it. Now, that's just advancing you a loan to be able to take out the property. So let's just say it's a 12-month term. You're trying to buy a property to, you know, do a fix and flip on. Well, it allows you to not use all your cash to acquire the property. Rather, you can take the loan out, you know, pay the fee for 20% down payment, and then maybe use your own cash to be able to do the improvements and then sell that loan.
So, and what would the general terms be on there? Like how much down, points, things like that?
Yeah, so we're looking 20 to 25% down depending on the project and the loan amount. You're also going to be looking towards 12-month term on there, and you're looking at Wall Street Journal Prime plus 1% to 2.5% is kind of generally what you're going to see from that side of things.
And that would be interest-only payments for that
interest-only
first year?
Payments. And so, and obviously upon the sale of that property is where how that loan's going to be repaid. So principal reductions aren't necessary.
And do you charge points up front?
Yep. So 1 point per 12 months.
Okay, so if it goes, so per 12 months, so if I go 24 months, it'd be 2 points. Is that the
correct
way I understand?
But we do max it at 12 months, and then, you know, we can extend that should, you know, the property be up for, you know, sale still or still improvements taking place. We can extend that on 3-month basis.
And then with the 20 to 25% down, is that just the purchase price, or is that including purchase price? And you guys also fund like the escrow improve, or like the improvement escrow.
So that'll be just the purchase price.
Okay. So I'd have to put 20, 25% down plus fund the improvements out of my pocket.
Yes. Okay. And no, I mean, there's other loan products that you could kind of pair with that. Whether you take out a line of credit on a separate property, you can utilize that as well. But generally, yeah, we'll see people take the property down with that regular single advance and then use their own cash.
Okay, great. I know I keep interrupting to ask questions. So what other products does First Bank offer?
Yeah, definitely. So I would say outside of, you know, the mortgages, commercial real estate, and the fix and flip, we are also offering construction loans, whether that be for spec or for consumer purpose, you know, building your primary residence. Business loans, you know, we do offer those, whether that be a SBA 7A loan or a kind of portfolio First Bank loan that we do keep on our books, as well as kind of your general junior lien, home equity, lines of credit, installment loans. So kind of cover everything under the rainbow.
And for those HELOCs, what's the kind of like combined LTV that First Bank will go up to?
Generally around 80%. And in some instances, we're willing to go up to 90, generally for, you know, consumer purpose needs. But where we want to be somewhat hesitant in that is once we go above that 80%, should the value of the property dip and the person need to refinance because that variable rate skyrocketed, you know, we can't put you back into a private mortgage insurance loan. So that's kind of the thought process of why you wouldn't want to go above 80% to originate that. But in some instances, we can.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Now, I know I'm jumping all over the place here, but I've got all these questions I want to ask you, John. So we've had a lot of clients work with you when they buy a condo that's non-warrantable. Mm-hmm. So that's obviously a portfolio product because conventional lending won't, you know, underwrite non-warrantable. What are the underwriting guidelines that First Bank looks at as far as like the complex and if they'll underwrite it or not?
Yeah, so there's a variety of things that we look at. That's going to be determined by a condo questionnaire. And what that condo questionnaire is going to do, it's a moment in time. So usually a representative from the management company, HOA, will fill that out. And that'll just describe the state of the HOA at that point in time. And that'll give you how many investor-occupied units there are in comparison to owner-occupied units, that being the primary one, that being around a 50%. So once we exceed 50% investor-occupied, that's when it's considered non-warrantable.
But you'll still loan on that, right?
We'll still loan on that. Yeah, and in majority of instances, we will lend into a non-warrantable condo. Difference being between if it were to be, you know, your standard single family property is there is a 5% loan to value deduction. So rather than bringing 20% to get that property, you have to bring 25% because there is additional risk associated with it. But that condo questionnaire, going back to it, will give you a lot of information to be able to understand if it is non-warrantable or if it's a warrantable condo. And so getting, you know, utilizing your broker and agent to, you know, gather as much information on the front end would be able to tell you a lot about should these condos be that way.
And in what situations will you not loan on a complex? Is there like for your, as far as your risk portfolio or just general guidelines?
Yeah, I'd say generally the ones that are going to have additional scrutiny and approval are going to be the ones that require or that are pending litigation.
Okay.
So that, once again, there's a little nuance to that. If it's pending litigation because maybe the HOA is looking towards, you know, litigating with their insurance company over a certain amount of, you know, hail damage proceeds. Well, that feels a little bit different than should someone have slipped and fell and it was mishandled and someone's suing them. So that's where there's going to be a variety of kind of understanding. And we really do need to get an understanding of what's going on with that litigation.
And there have been some complexes we've looked at with clients where as First Banks looked into it, you guys said you already have too many loans in that complex. Mm-hmm. And I can't recall the details. I can't recall the complexes, but I'm assuming there's a certain percentage you don't want to lend more than X percent per complex.
Correct. So where we identify additional undue risk is going to be based off of the concentration of our loans in that complex. So we're not going to want to lend probably over around 30% of that complex. So let's just say there's 90 properties in that complex. We're not going to want loans on more than 30 of those.
Okay.
Generally speaking. So that's just kind of an internal policy because should obviously market go south, we'll find ourselves holding the bag with a lot of, you know, bum condos.
And how did First Banks do through the credit crunch? What, I guess 12 years ago now, 10 years ago?
Yeah, so I'd say we thrived. Admittedly, I was not there during that point in time, but you know, you talk to any of the senior officers and people who were there, and while banks were stopped lending, we continued to lend, and we kind of became a safe haven due to the fact that I'd say we are common sense lenders, and we want to take a look at it. And if it seems to make sense, it makes sense. We'll do that loan. If it doesn't, we'll let you know. And I think that's proven to serve us well through the credit crunches and through a variety of other recessions that we've survived through.
That's great. So you guys, obviously your lending guidelines proved very prudent.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, we had a record, you know, year over year record years, you know, through that time frame, because all your big banks stopped lending and, you know, we continued to make those loans based off of what we felt comfortable with.
And a question I forgot to ask you with the LLCs, I had someone that wanted me to ask you this. Do you guys do like self-directed 401k IRA loans?
Yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned that. So we do offer IRA loans, self-directed, usually through an intermediary or through an LLC. I'd say oftentimes we'll see it set up through an attorney, as they'll be the intermediary during those cases. But that is technically a non-recourse loan. So we are limited to 65% loan to value in those instances, but it would be a loan directly to the IRA, and the person who owns the IRA is the beneficiary. And that's where it's really important that you have a good intermediary in those instances, because my understanding is it can trigger a lot of taxable events if there's not that, you know, very bold line between the two.
So you do a 65% LTV because it's non-recourse. Now, if I buy a property through my self-directed IRA, then buy a property through just myself, are the rates and terms going to be similar? Like, or what's different about the terms you give on the self-directed IRA loan?
Yeah, there will be a little bit of a premium on the self-directed IRA loans. Once again, there's just additional risk when you don't have any personal guarantee backing that. You know, should that go south, there's really not a lot of recourse that you have to be able to go back and remedy that loan.
So that means like, is it like points up front or just a slightly higher interest rate? Or can you say, because it depends, or can't you say it?
I would say it depends. I'd say you're going to look up more on a premium of the interest rate, you know, on our investment, because it is an investment property mortgage. You know, the standard origination is 1.5%. Now that's obviously a little hefty, and we understand that. And so we offer, you know, a little bit of a trade-off where we can decrease that origination by 0.5% and increase the rate by 0.125%.
Okay.
So should that be a little bit difficult to be able to manage, then we can kind of help limit that upfront cost.
So here's another question I got for you. So, you know, if I have a checking account with you guys and my savings account, does that make any difference when I come to you and say, hey, I want to buy a rental property?
Yes and no. I would say
what a great answer.
I would say first and foremost, yeah, not to be vague. First and foremost, we are a relationship lender, and you'll hear several banking officers throughout the First Bank system say that. And really what that means is, you know, typically, we're lending the money that we hold on deposit because we are a bank, and therefore, you know, we would like some reciprocation in that case where we'd like to, you know, have your deposits. Now, what it comes down to is I think we're very confident in our abilities, and we understand that we can offer all the products that the big banks offer and a customer service of a community bank. So we feel very confident that we can serve your needs. And so while we're providing loan products to you, we feel like it'd be, you know, prudent to ask for your deposit relationship. So that's kind of the first side where it does matter in that side. We want to be a relationship bank, and with a relationship that's being mutual, right? We're providing opportunity and options to you while you're obviously providing, you know, something for us to be able to go out there, make more loans, and continue to grow our brand and grow our bank. Now, on the opposite side, you know, let's just say that the rate's currently at 5% and 1.5% fee, and you're going to drop $250,000 in the bank, and that's no small amount. We can't adjust the rate or the origination based off of a relationship.
Okay.
Due to the fact of fair lending issues, that can become, given the fact it is residential. However, it's not consumer loan. It is a residential mortgage, and that falls under a different type of regulation. So that's where we get a little bit different. Now, if you're going to be looking towards taking down a large property and you're going to, let's just say, dump several million in the bank, that can be a little bit different of a conversation, because that's a true commercial real estate deal. It's regulated differently, and that's where it feels a little bit different.
That's interesting. Okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, it makes perfect sense what you say, but I never thought about the, you know, kind of like that aspect of the law creeping into that side of banking.
Yeah. And now I'll say, you know, as you develop your relationship with us and our relationship with you, and, you know, let's just say you start to have 10, 15 mortgages with us, the pricing is based off of a tier, which 10 finance properties and above 10 finance properties. So, you know, if that relationship's very solid and you know, that's mutual and we see that, it does help through, you know, additional approval processes, because while we don't have a cap on the amount of mortgages we can do, you know, there are certain things that we would need to see in approval processes we have to go through, such as maybe shorter amortizations, going towards 15 years instead of 30 years, or going towards higher liquidity, just to make sure that should there be a, you know, some type of recession, that, you know, you're set up to succeed and thrive through that as well, as long as we are as well.
And something I forgot to ask you earlier, we're going to talk about some of your loan products for investment properties, just, I'll say, you know, the single family homes, duplexes, triplexes, the smaller investment properties that a lot of our clients go for. What are the terms on there on the portfolio side? Is that a 5-year, 7-year arm? Like, what are the basic options that First Bank offers?
Yeah, definitely. I'd say your standard one that you're going to see is going to be a 5-1 arm over 30 years and a 7-1 arm over 30 years. We call them our firm 5 and our firm 7, but it's going to be fixed for the first 5 or 7 years, right, through that fixed initial rate period. The payment's going to be based off the 30 years. And then we do have some caps to that to make sure that, you know, if the interest rates were to skyrocket, that it doesn't, you know, impact you ultimately. So you're going to look for, if it's going to be on the 5-year loan, no more than 2% after year 5, and no more than 2% every year thereafter, and no more than 5% over the life of the loan. So that's just, say you have a 5% interest rate loan right now, it'll never go higher than 10%.
Okay, and then no more, it can never increase more than 2% per year.
Correct.
Okay.
And the only difference with the 7-1 arm is there is going to be a 3-year cap on that first year. It can adjust up to 3%. After year 7.
But it's still a total of like 5%.
Total of 5.
Lifetime cap?
Yep. And it's over 2% every year thereafter, and 5% over the life of the loan.
Now, and I know it's very hard to say this because interest rates change, you know, every second. But I mean, for those 5 and 7-year arms, is there a general like percentage rate point difference between that and like a conventional loan, or something that just gives our listeners just a very quick basis, like, hey, if I can get a conventional at 5% now, typically a 5 or 7-year arms are a point more, a half a point more, 2 points more.
Yeah. So if you're going to go for a, let's just stick with the 30-year fixed. Let's just say that if you were to go with a conventional loan, 30-year fixed, the adjustable rate mortgage could be anywhere between 0.5% to 0.75% lower in interest rate. Because ultimately, it is going to be interest rate risk to the borrower, and therefore a lower initial interest rate.
Okay. Now, let me ask you about my situation, because I'm actually playing this scenario right now. Because before I got into real estate investing and before I became an agent, I bought a condo in Reno, Nevada. Like, it was actually at the very bottom, just kind of dumb luck I bought at the very bottom. I wasn't trying to. I just knew I didn't think prices would go much lower, but I bought for, I think it's like $68,000 back then, 2011. Now it's worth like $230 or so. I got like about $40,000 left on the private note I got on there. And I'm running scenarios and I'm talking to lenders out in Reno, conventional and portfolio lenders out there to see what type of, you know, money I can pull out. And I'm also debating, hey, do I just sell it and then bring the money out here to Denver? So the first scenario, let's say I pull out money from there. So I take out a new loan on there. Does it matter from your point, is it, if it's a conventional loan or a portfolio loan, does that impact anything that the conversation I have with you when I want to buy property in Denver?
No.
Okay.
So it's no matter which route you were to go, conventional or portfolio, at the end of the day, we're going to look at that debt very similar. I'd say the message I'd send is, if you're going to go conventional, it's a little bit different of an underwriting process and documentation needed. So that's a discussion. If you were to go that route, we would make sure to get you a kind of a checklist of what we're going to need, as opposed to with the portfolio, it'd be just a
slightly different. Well, I'm talking about out in Reno when I refinance it.
Oh,
so
okay.
Does it matter what type of loan product I get, or is it all matter when I come to you and say, hey, I pulled out, you know, $150,000 from my property? Do you care what type it is, or do you just care about what my debt to income ratio is based off of that refinance?
Oh, yeah. Thanks for that clarification. So we would be looking based off of, we do not care what that ends up being.
Okay.
we're going to look at what is that monthly payment associated with that property, and we'll utilize that in our underwriting.
And then you say that property, because I mean, it's not just that payment based off of that property, based off the rent. It would go in my bigger picture of my overall personal income and debt to income ratio, right?
Correct. So we would look at, you have the debt associated with it, right?
Yeah.
And that's going to be part of the, obviously, the debt calculation. You're going to be receiving income from that as well through your rent. So we'll give you obviously credit for the rent. And then obviously we're going to discount due to the debt that you have.
Okay.
So, you know, it will ultimately net out to what your cash flow is. Now, we're obviously going to look at it. If we don't have tax returns or an executed lease, we will discount it by around 25% to account for any potential expenses.
But if, no, I mean, I've paid taxes on the rental income. Mm-hmm. I've got, you know, a lease, so you'd actually count 100% of the income on there?
So we would base it off of what that tax return shows.
Okay.
So we would underwrite what the income, the expenses, and then we would add back depreciation and interest, because that's not a true cash expense.
And this, I'm going to actually throw some numbers at you just for example reasons. These aren't the actual numbers, just rounded for simplicity. But let's say I have $1,000 a month in rent, mm-hmm. and I refinance it, and I have just say $1,000 a month, you know, in my loan payback of principal interest.
Mm-hmm.
That's not including HOA and taxes and things like that. How do you take those numbers into your underwriting equation?
So we are going to look at it from a principal interest, tax, and insurance standpoint.
Okay.
So therefore, you would have a little bit of a deficiency where you wouldn't be receiving the rent to cover your principal interest, tax, insurance, and HOA. So we would look at it from a wholesome approach, because ultimately what we want to understand is how much more debt can you take on without becoming, you know, waterlogged, so to speak. And so we're going to look at it from a holistic approach, because we're going to look at it from a true debt obligation standpoint.
And you say true, you mean like my personal Chris Lopez debt obligation standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I flip the script on you and let's say, because the actual rent's $1,200 a month is what I'm getting. And, you know, after PITI and HOA expenses, let's say that's $1,000 a month for everything. Mm-hmm. How does that play out?
So we would look at that and we'd see that, you know, you're cash flowing $200.
Yeah.
Now, are we talking just the high, you know, quick and dirty? That's what your, you know, net is going to be, $200. Now, if we're going to look at through a tax return, you'll also see that there are other expenses in there, and that will be backed out as well. So when push comes to shove, you will probably see a little bit of deficiency there, but that's going to be specific to
each
property.
You're right. No, I absolutely do.
You know.
Okay. But then still, that would always ultimately roll back into, so it's kind of like you look at the property first, but ultimately just, I'll say, rolls back to me as the person and what I can handle based off of my overall income and DTI.
Correct. We will always draw it right back to the individual who's backing the debt. And that kind of goes back to, we'll do loans to LLCs all day, help, you know, match the vesting on the title to the loan. But when push comes to shove, we want to make sure that the person who's backing that entity can back the debt. Should it dissolve, should everything go south, that they'll still be able to repay that loan.
And do you ever do like strictly pure asset-based lending?
No, we're not an asset-based lender. You know, the closest thing that we would ever have towards that is in our business lending products, we will start looking towards accounts receivable, inventory, stuff like that. But, you know, it's not going to be a true asset-based lending style, because we're going to kind of secure it against other things as well, or look to.
Okay. Now, let's just say the other scenario I'm playing around with, let's just say I sell my property, I bring the cash out here. Well, then there's no loans to take care of. And then it's just basically all the other underwriting guidelines that we just spent the last 40 minutes talking about of, okay, what's the property I'm buying? What's my overall income and DTI, right?
Yep. So we'll look at it. What's your DTI right now? What about how much can you afford to take on more debt?
Perfect. That's actually good. Thank you. Actually, I learned quite a few things today.
Yeah.
So I'm looking here at more of my questions I have for you. One thing I do want to ask you, did I miss any of the common questions or issues that come up as you talk to clients or investors that you get asked all the time?
Yeah, I would say the first thing is I think you hit on it very early on, but oftentimes people, if they make a loan to an LLC, they don't want to necessarily be on that. Just to confirm, we do look for the personal guarantee. So that's kind of the first thing that I always make sure that people are aware of when we are tying it to an LLC. I would say other than that, you pretty much hit on everything that people are going to be bumping into. Obviously, everyone's situation is a little bit unique, so it's always good to be forthright in that. I would say another thing that you run into is cross-collateralized type lending. So what if I were to take my 5 condos that I own right now, maybe free and clear, and do one loan under all that, maybe a line of credit? Well, that's going to fall under more of your true commercial real estate type lending because there's multiple deed of trusts needed. So I'd say that's the other thing that people can be aware of, is that that's a very unique product, a very creative product, but it is going to fall under a little bit different of an underwriting guideline and product pricing.
Okay. Now, really random, nuanced question for you. Since you know the LOCs, you require the personal guarantees, mm-hmm. I understand. Why doesn't First Bank offer a 65% loan-to-value non-recourse on LLC when you'll do that for a self-directed IRA?
Well, self-directed IRA is a little bit different in the sense that there's a little bit more security there just due to the tax implications. People aren't going to typically liquidate an IRA. Now, there's an exception to every rule, so I'm not going to sit there and say that there's no way that we'll never do a non-recourse loan. But that's typically what we're going to request and ask for. But like I said, there's an exception to every rule.
And that's because since you guys are on the portfolio side, you guys can actually, because what I mean, I'm assuming you or committee sits around and looks at things and say, hey, you know what? This makes sense to us. Let's underwrite it. And that's where you can have those exceptions.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. And once again, going back to a relationship type thing. If we see.
So you, I know you work with, you know, all types of lending products. What are some of the common mistakes you see people make when it comes to loan products or their, you know, personal finances that end up hurting them and getting a loan? Like, what advice can you give people out there?
I'd say it's all about credit cards. In my opinion, you oftentimes see, because credit cards aren't assessed, underwritten based off of maybe what that minimum monthly payment is. It's going to be assessed based off of a payment factor. And that payment factor is going to account for what's it cost to pay this loan down. And so people may say, I have a $5,000 credit card and my minimum monthly payment's $100. Well, we're not going to underwrite it that way because we want to see that eventually be paid back. So I'd say that hinders people, because when you're talking about, you know, underwriting and you're looking at maybe $25,000 worth of credit card debt, well, you're going to be looking at a hefty monthly payment, and that ultimately impacts their ability to afford that new investment property, that new home.
So if I understood you correctly, I know, you know, credit cards have their, like, I think it's like 2% required minimum payment or 1%. I know it's extremely low. But if you guys get someone through a credit card debt, you're like, yeah, they only require you $100 a month back, but we're actually looking at this and we're going to budget $400 a month. You actually budget more?
Yeah, so we'll base it off of a 3% payment factor.
Okay.
So that's where it'll be a little bit different. And oftentimes you'll have this situation where the person has $20,000 credit card debt because they took out a credit card and that credit card company had a, you know, 12-month 0% APR. So they then charge that credit card up because they're not having to pay interest on that. And that makes sense and understandable, but we understand that also that interest rate will eventually go up. So we're going to still underwrite it to that 3% payment factor across the board.
Because it'll go back up to the 18.99% or whatever, right?
25%, it's a little bit different. So,
great. So what other issues or common problems do you see with just, you know, underwriting people in general?
Yeah, I would say the next thing outside of, you know, just basic credit where that's going to impact our ability to give you more debt is going to be from an income perspective. Going back to, you know, self-employment, it totally makes sense to, you know, write off what you can because you'll need to, and that's an expense. But to the extent you can, we do have to underwrite to tax returns. So realize that sometimes those write-offs do kind of hinder your ability to take on more debt.
So, and this might be an impossible question for you, but, you know, for the self-employed people that, you know, play the game, and I do it myself, you want to maximize tax deductions.
Sure.
Where's that? Is there a sweet spot as far as, like, you know what, I'm going to, you know, not write off everything so I can show more profit? Or is it all just come back to ultimately like that front end 2-to-1 ratio, whatever works on that?
Well, I think it comes back to, you'll have the person who comes into the bank and says, I make $10,000 per month, and you very well can make $10,000 per month. The best way is to match your tax return to match that $10,000 per month income, okay, because that's what their expectation is, right? So if we're going to be on an equal playing field, allow me to count that $10,000 per month, and then there's not going to be that disappointment there on the end of, hey, I really make this much. Well, I can't say that based off of the documentation and file.
That makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. So another question here. I know you rattled off quite a few different loan products that First Pink offers. Are you able to do all of them, or do you guys have, like, I'll say loan specialists for this type of loan, that type of loan? So if someone wants to talk to you, should they call you or a different person at the bank?
Yeah, so I'd say we're a lot different than banks out there, is we do fall under a generalist model. So as a banking officer with First Bank, we are going to learn how to lend in the residential field, the commercial field, the business lending field. And while there are certain scopes of loans that maybe get a little bit out of hand, we may still have our hand in it, and that's a learning process. And, you know, to ensure that the customer isn't impacted negatively, there is a mentorship with a senior officer where they may help provide guidance and understanding, and to ensure that we get that loan approved and funded on time, but also gain the experience so that eventually those that are sitting in the learning seat can be in the driver's seat.
Great. And if people want to reach out to you, John, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
Yeah, I'd say the best way to reach out to me and any other officer at First Bank is going to be via our direct phone line or our email. Mine personally is john.wilms@firstbank.com. Wilms spelled W-I-L-M-S. And then my phone number is 303-456-2356.
And I'll stick all those in the show notes as well. John, so any final thoughts or things you want to share with us before we wrap things up?
No, I would just say I appreciate you having me on, Chris. And, you know, should you have any questions, don't hesitate to reach out. Stop by your local First Bank and ask those questions, especially, you know, on the front end. Ask the questions, have the conversation, and then that way we can provide a realistic answer as quick as possible to make sure that moving forward, you can get all your goals accomplished that you're looking for.
Great. Well, thanks, John. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Chris.